When your furnace or air conditioner quits, you need it fixed, fast. This is Dennis Sullivan, president of CARE Heating and Cooling. Our technicians are paid to fix your HVAC system, not sell you a new one. We show up on time, diagnose the problem, and get you comfortable again, without the high-pressure sales pitch. It's our commitment to honesty and craftsmanship that helped us win the Lennox Partner of the Year Award and a BBB Torch Award for Ethics last year. So, call CARE Heating and Cooling at 1-800-COOLING or book an appointment online at careheatingandcooling.com. When you need a company you can trust.
Welcome to another episode of Solano Moms Building Community Podcast. Today we're honored to have a very special guest, Dr. Crystal Collier, an expert in neurodevelopment and prevention science, whose work is helping parents raise resilient, healthy children by guiding them away from high-risk behaviors. Dr. Collier's validated neurodevelopment approach gives parents the tools to understand how the brain develops and why it matters, how risky behaviors can impact the development, what parents can do to keep their children on a positive path. Her book, The New Whereabouts Guide, is a must-have resource for parents, breaking down complex science in a fun, engaging, and infographic-style format, making it easy to apply prevention strategies from elementary school through college. In this episode, we will dive into how parents can take a proactive role in supporting their children's brain health, decision-making, and overall well-being. If you ever have wondered how to help your child navigate today's challenges with confidence, this episode is for you. I would like to welcome my special guest, Dr. Crystal Collier, author of your Know Your Neuro book series, to my podcast. Thank you so much for being here. I know the time shift. You're in Texas. I'm in California. We're trying to figure out, but right here we are.
Yes. Thank you for having me. It's such an honor.
Of course. Honor is mine. Your books are amazing. I have been reading. Actually, I wanted to bring one of the books here to read the parts that I think it is so important, talking about your neuro to kids and how it brings awareness and teaches them at a young age how to say no, how to make good decision making. I mean, we all went through this as teenagers, as young adolescents, where we didn't know how to cope with things and how to say no to something. But your books, finally, there's a book that is telling us and teaching us this. So this is amazing. Before I go too much excitement about your books, I would like you to share a little bit about your journey to our listeners.
For sure. You know, it started off when I was a kid and my parents were going through relationship issues, divorce, and that unfortunately a lot of kids have to go through when they grow up. It was just the timing of it was right around adolescence for me. I was just moving into 11, 12, 13 years old when all those changes were happening. And it was just really tough to change schools. And so I thought that I had a great idea to take summer school classes to get to know kids before I went to this new school. And what I learned is that there are a lot of great kids who go to summer school who have made a lot of bad decisions. And a couple of those kids introduced me to some risky behavior, alcohol and drugs. And, you know, it's interesting to me, too, because I was always a really good straight A academically, you know, doing well kid and also a rule follower. You know, I didn't really like breaking rules. It was anxiety provoking for me. So I really experimented with risky behavior. Much to the surprise of my mother later on, who did not really realize what was going on. But, you know, she had a lot of issues of her own happening, and I'm an only child. And so I was just looking to feel comfortable in my own skin. And so then, of course, I had an overdose when I was 18, and by the grace of God, survived it and went to rehab. And from there, I stayed sober. As a matter of fact, today is a really special day for me because my sobriety birthday is February 3rd, 1989.
So, oh my God, this congratulations! I feel so special being part of this day with you.
Thank you. Me too. Wow. I really do.
Wow, it's such a thanks for being with us and on this special day.
What a cool gift to be able to share my story and all the information that I've learned about the brain on the day that I'm celebrating 36 years of recovery. So You know, when I got into recovery, I started studying the brain because I wanted to understand why I made all of these decisions. I couldn't understand why this great, cute, smart kid, you know, did so many things that really sabotaged my success. And so I started studying about the brain and started creating presentations about it and was able to eventually write a book and a kid's book. And right now it's really cool because I've got a group of high school and college interns who are helping me write a teen version of the Parent Guide.
Wow, we have to interview you for that one when it comes.
Absolutely. Well, I'd love for you to interview some of the young people that I'm working with too, because what we've known in the literature and in the stats is that the majority of kids don't engage in risky behavior. The majority don't, but they're silent. And so how do we give them a voice? And I've been working with, you know, 28 of them actually over the past couple of years, and I listening to them talk about, yeah, none of my friends do this, but everybody think everybody does. So how can I help dispel that myth? And I'm like, then let's write about it. Let's put social media out there. And they're all for it, giving a voice to the majority of kids who make better decisions and are starting to really learn about their brain.
Yeah, I find it very empowering about you starting at an adolescent age, because I think at least when I was growing up, it was so much focused when you're an adult to make the right decision. But what we didn't realize, it's so much at adolescent being, informed and well educated on these subjects. So when you're an adult, you don't make those decisions. And for you to do that with those 28 students, teaching them the right way and making them well informed is amazing, because then by the time they are adult, they are more productive adults, they are healthier adults. And that's amazing. So with you telling me that you learned why you did that behavior, please tell our listeners why we make those decisions as a teenager and what happens. So we teach our kids. I have two sons. I have one is 5, one is 9. I want to make sure they don't do that.
This is such perfect timing, really, for that, because I think that we should start having prevention conversations at about 7, 8 years old. And of course, every parent knows their kid and knows what is appropriate and not. But we start to be inundated with high-risk behavior at that age. And wow. So I think what's important to know about kids is their neuro whereabouts. That's why I made up a word. It's actually in the Urban Dictionary. And the word means knowing where in your child's neurodevelopment they are, what they can do and what they can't do, and how much you should function as their frontal lobe until they grow one of their own. So if we take me for an example, when I was 11, 12, 13 years old, I had about 15% of my frontal lobe. So the part of my brain that really is online and making adult decisions was only 15% developed at that point. So that's impulse control, emotion regulation, empathy, problem solving, all of the important decision-making skills. Those were only at about 15% online. And so to be given access to the World Wide Web, or in my case, the world, because I didn't have a lot of rules about where I went or who I was with, it just put me in a lot of situations that I was not really capable of making good decisions about. And so knowing your child's neuro whereabouts is really helpful, because if you know what to expect, you know what puberty does. One of the things that really irks me about the way we talk about teenagers as if it's this horrible time of tumultuousness. And it is internally for a kid. And, you know, you will learn this as your children move into adolescence. They will change personalities and start to push away from you. But it's important that they do, because they have to go create their own identity, figure out who they are, stand on their own 2 feet. Now, that doesn't mean you have to accept disrespectful behavior, But the idea is, if you know what's coming, you'll know what's normal and healthy. Be able to normalize and validate that for them while you're creating good guardrails.
Wow, that's wonderful. I am going to be ready for that stage. I actually always tell my boys, because my major is epidemiology. Mm-hmm. So I have studied a little bit of, like, you know, what goes on with teenager and hormones and biology and the body. So I always tell them, when you're a teenager, you're going to be off. And please just remember that mommy and daddy love you, and whatever we tell you, it's best for you.
Exactly. Yes. Right now, yes. Right, he says, okay, yes, mom. You know, when he's 14, he'll not say yes, mom.
Oh God, I have to videotape him and then show him. Do you remember this?
Yes.
And then, like you said, 15% of your frontal lobe is basically live making decisions at age, when you're a teenager. Yes. So how at that point can I, for my son, what strategies should I use to get that 15% make better decisions?
Sure. So there is a two-pronged approach. One is memorize the executive functioning skills that the brain is growing and allow kids to grow them, foster that growth. One of the best ways to foster executive functioning skills is through chores. So your rule should be, if they can, they should. If they can, they should. If they can wash dishes, they should. If they can clean their room, they should. If they can do their laundry, they should. If they can take the dog out, right? All of these things. Once they can, they should. So starting to add on, this is your responsibility as your brain grows and develops as a part of this family. And then when you see them using these executive functioning skills, like selective attention, task initiation, impulse control, good problem solving, then reward those. I call it brain-based praise. So in my book, in the brain development chapter, which is the first chapter, you'll see the list of executive functioning skills. If you memorize those and incorporate them into your daily language, then you can praise them for those things and figure out ways to create tasks that they can do those things instead of over-functioning and doing it for them because it's quicker. We want to teach them how to do it. And then the second approach of that prong is have the conversations and set your expectations about risky behavior before. So in the Neuro Whereabouts Guide, the parent guide, I actually graphed all the 18 high-risk behaviors so you can see, okay, when do they start going up? We want to have that prevention conversation before the peak, not after, right? We want to definitely have, what I always challenge parents to do is to have 6 conversations per year. And where you bring up the topic, and using prevention dates is great. You know, like you can say, hey, this week is National Eating Disorders Week. Have you ever heard of eating disorders? And sometimes the kids will be like, mom, what are you talking about? That's good, right? If they don't know yet, but one of those years, if you have that conversation on the same week every year, one year your kid is going to say, oh yeah, Sally has anorexia. And then your next comment should be the 3 magic words, tell me more. Let them talk about this. And then you refer back to what I'll talk about later is your family code. You've already created a code. These are the expectations about keeping your brain safe from risky behavior. So you refer back to the code and say, man, you know, that's something we don't do in our family. We don't hurt our brain. And eating disorders can have a really negative effect on brain development. And so if you ever have, you know, body image issues or you hear about that, come talk to me. And if you don't feel comfortable talking to me, I get that. I'm your mom. I'm your dad. Then we'll find an expert for you to talk to about that. So do you see the two-pronged approach? You're going to increase executive functioning skills, and then you're going to protect those skills with expectations about no engagement in risky behavior.
Wow, that's amazing. That's a lot to take in, but it's amazing. And then for these 6 things that you said every year to talk. So from what I got is that it has to be consistently the same topic?
No, it doesn't. What you want to do is first create a family code. So this is the biggest piece of wisdom I think that I have for families out there, is that
when your kids are about 7, 8 years old, but you can do it anytime. If your kids are 15 or 25, you can sit down and say, hey, I want to create a family code. 3 or 4 sentences that outline your values and the no's. So like, we value our brain development. We value kindness, consideration, and respect. We protect our brain from risky behavior. So we don't do drugs or alcohol, alcohol only when we're 21. We don't do anything that could hurt the brain. Bam. Put that, I have an activity in the tools section of my book that shows parents in 3 steps how to create a code. I'm actually creating an app that parents can create it and then upload it to the app. And the app will send you 6 prompts every year to have conversations. And then you pick the prevention days: Eating Disorder Week, National Smokeout Day, you know, National Alcoholism Prevention Day, whatever those 6 are. And then you talk about that. That's your segue. Hey, did you guys know it's National Smokeout Day? Do you know anybody who smokes or vapes? And then when they say yes or no, whatever it is, you just refer back to the family code and say, well, in our family, this is our code. That's it. 10-minute conversation, 6 times per year. What that does is 2 things. 1, it creates family unity. Your kids know that everybody in the family has this beautiful belief to protect their brain. Everyone does. And so then when kids go out into the world, they already know what your expectation is. And if somebody prompts them, suggests them, tries to engage them in a risky behavior, your kids can say, oh, no, no, that's not what we do in my family. My mom would kill me if I did that. Oh, no, no. Now, about 85% of the time, kids are going to do that if you have set the expectation. That number goes down if kids don't know. And I'm a good example of that. Like, I didn't know what my family's expectation was. So when I went out there in the world and somebody offered me something, I said yes. If I had known that my mother or my father were really against that, I would have an 85% chance of saying no. So I think what you're doing is adding that percentage in and then bolstering it by just having 6 conversations per year. You're not lecturing, you're just reinforcing your family code. The second thing, so it creates unity and then it creates expectation, right? So you want them to feel more attached to you, more interested in upholding your family code. And when kids are little, they want to please us, right? They want to be a good girl, you know, or a good boy. But once they get into teenage years, they're not as concerned about that anymore, right? They don't, you know, they're...
Oh, yeah. Yes. At that stage, it's all about them, right? At least that's how you feel as a parent. And I mean, I don't blame them because we all did it. Sometimes I think about when I was a teenager, I'm like, oh my God, my poor mom and dad. Like, you're in a world that you don't even know what you're doing yourself.
Yes, absolutely. And it's fun and exciting and scary all at once. And this is when, you know, whatever frontal lobe development we already have in there is reduced in power the more friends we're around, the more peer influencers are there. So what you want to do is help kids by helping them program their own brain with the message of what to do in situations. And the research shows that as kids grow older, they may not care as much about what you think or what you want unless it's a crisis. When kids are in crisis, they need us. They need us to be there. But those crises come, you know, a little bit later usually. So we want to make sure they know ahead of time by repeating it. That's why having 6 10-minute conversations per year. And then also, of course, when it comes up in conversation, you know, a kid's going to get in trouble for telling other kids to send them a nude on their phone that they just got when they're 11 years old, unfortunately. And so, you know, you want to have a conversation that says, if somebody asks you for a bad picture, if somebody tries to show you a picture of somebody that is nude, what are you going to do? Like in our family code, that's not what we do. But let's talk about what your refusal skills are. How would you say no to that in a hip, slick, and cool way? So if you practice that with kids, they're so much more likely to actually use that script when they go out in the world.
Actually, this is so true. I'll tell you a personal story. This was my son, the oldest one that's 9 now. I believe he was 7. So we went to a birthday party And then some kids were, we didn't know, they were in their room with the iPad, and he had gone there too. And he said they were looking at pictures that were not appropriate. I don't think it was nude, but it wasn't appropriate to what our family, now that I'm learning from you, it's a code that we tell them, this is not what in our family do, but whatever others do, let them do it and respect what they're doing. But this is not how we do it. That's how my husband and I tell him. And then he came after the party was done. He said, oh, mommy, daddy, they were looking at things, but I came out and I said, oh, this is not what I want to do. Some words he said like that, but he basically told them, this is not what I do, but it's okay. So I'm glad that you said that. That reassures me that we said the right thing to him.
Yes, absolutely. You are right on track. And how did he react?
He was a little, I think, when he came, he was very excited to tell us, first of all, in the car, that I did something right. And also, my husband and I, a lot of time, what we learn is we tell the boys something, and I think in their head, they're like, oh, mom and dad are too much, or I don't know what they think, but it feels like they're not regarding it. But when they go to the real world, they experience it, they're in a kind of excitement to tell us, you were right, it did happen, and now I said this. And for me, that moment is like my glory moment. I'm like, finally, because I feel like sometimes I feel like, oh my God, am I making them paranoid? Am I raising them to be too paranoid? But then when they see the reality, it gives them power that to say what we have told them the right way. For our family, again, I like that you say this is code for your family. For another one, might be okay. But for ours, it wasn't. And I like that they see it okay, that they also encounter these things. I think they, as a child, they believe like they're not going to encounter this.
Well, of course, because kids think, oh, that'll never happen to me. But we know as adults how many risky behaviors are out there in the world. We know that. And it's interesting, my prevention program, knowyourneuro.org, is a free prevention program that has videos for kids from K through 12. It's designed to be used at home and in school. I had a teacher reach out to me the other day, and she said, you know, I've got kids who are like, oh my God, the brain again. But then when we do the lesson, they always go, oh, that was really interesting. And they, right. So initially kids are going to be like, oh, mom, oh, that's not going to happen. Or again, we have to talk about this again. Those are things that are just power struggle worms they put in the water because their brain is developing good abstract arguing skills. Don't bite those worms. Don't bite them. You know what the good parenting techniques are, and you can just validate, like, I know, learning about the brain. Here we go again. Let's go. Here's something new. Let me tell you what is new, or here's a new risky behavior. Have you seen this? And once they get engaged, they absorb it. But that's what I love about teaching kids about the brain, is because there are so many risky behaviors out there that affect the brain in a similar way, but you can change up the conversation by changing up the risky behavior topic.
I fully agree. I think talking to you, it just opens even my frontal lobe more on how to make better decisions as a mom.
Music to my ears.
So today, so today when they wake up, my frontal lobe is going to work really well. Back to where you said that you did some risky behavior as a teenager. I wanted to ask, was this sometimes the risky behavior comes from family environment? You said your parents went through a separation, correct?
Yes.
Do you think this was a factor of that? Like, I just want to also tell the parents, like, how to make a healthy home environment so kids do not do risky behavior. Is it a factor of it? Or is it they will do it anyway, whether it's a healthy environment home or whether it's not?
That's a really great question. And there are so many factors, right? So it's really hard to point to one thing. But if you know neuro whereabouts, if you know how kids' brains develop, then you can learn first what healthy, secure attachment looks like. Then you can learn about helping create autonomy and building self-efficacy, which increases self-esteem. That comes a little bit later in life, right? The second stage. Well, please hear me. I see brain development in two large stages: birth to puberty, puberty to 25. But within those two stages, there are five sub-stages that each kid will go through different developmental challenges that you can learn about and support them in achieving. So when you know those things, then you're really creating this crucible of an environment. And then, but we know that kids who are more attached, kids who feel open and can talk about anything, kids who have emotional literacy, they can feel their feelings, kids who have good attention spans and connection to parents as they grow, kids who eat family dinners together a lot with their family. These are all protective factors that decrease the risk of them engaging in high-risk behavior. But I have to say, I have seen kids grow up in those environments and still make mistakes and engage. But here's the cool thing. When that happens, the families are very supportive. They are forgiving, but they also give appropriate consequences. And the sooner that happens, then the sooner the child can feel the lesson from that and change their choices going on. We see that there are certain risk factors that put kids at risk: poor attachment, poor attention, concentration, connection with parents, lack of connection, lack of family meals together. When kids feel lonely or alone, depressed or anxious, if they're not really helped and supported, if they go through bullying at school and things like that, of course, then kids can turn to lots of other risky behavior to self-medicate that. And so if parents are not there, if they're disconnected and they don't see these things happening because of a lot of things that are going on in their life, yes, kids can make more risky behavior and suffer with mental health issues. So, you know, I think too, you know, 51% of first marriages end in divorce. But if parents understand there is a window of time when it's more detrimental for kids, and that's around puberty. You know, if you are able to handle it, go to couples therapy, either separate before, you know, the age 5, 6, 7 and separate after age 16, 17, you have a lot less likelihood of problems happening. Of course, kids are going to feel it no matter what. The younger they are, they may blame themselves. The older they are, they may estrange from a parent. But if they're going through puberty, remember that they need a foundation of who they are. The family is that foundation. So if the family cracks, then it's like the very foundation cracks for them. And building an identity on top of that is more difficult.
Wow. That's so important to know. Even, I think for me, whatever you're saying, I'm taking it all in. That even when, you know how you always have your stresses, to make sure when the kids are going through puberty, that's a time that where you have to fully focus on them. I mean, we're adults. We do have our stresses, but I have to find with my husband, if we do have stresses, to cope in a different way that the kids do not get affected by it, especially at those ages.
Definitely, yes.
Very well. The other question I have is, we're talking about risky behaviors. For some people that they don't know what risky behaviors are, what are some common ones that teenagers are prone
to? Sure. So alcohol, illicit drugs, marijuana. Those are the ones we kind of think of right off the bat, right? The kind of more obvious risky behavior that we won't. The less obvious, technology overuse, video game addiction, eating disorders, self-injury, dating violence, risky sexual behavior, pornography, gambling. So these are the ones that we don't necessarily think of right away, or we think, oh, we got plenty of time to worry about those. But the things that are pervasive in our world right now are technology overuse and screen use, and how that has a really negative effect on our brain development. And that can lead to a whole host of initiation into the world of risky behavior, especially gambling, pornography. I'm seeing kids younger and younger using it on a regular basis, learning about sex from that, and then having problems in college with violent behavior toward their sexual partners, and they're getting in trouble for that. But they learned about that on pornography instead of from their parents. And, you know, talking about sex with kids is difficult no matter what. No matter who you are, what parent you are, this is a tough conversation. And it has to happen younger, because kids are going to see things like that from their friends' phones, at their friends' houses. We want them to know what to do to say, no, I'm not going to look at those things. I talk about those things in private with my parents. I see a lot of dads feeling very unempowered to teach, especially their boys, about sex, about erections, about things that are normal and natural. And then when kids don't know what to expect, like for instance, when girls go through puberty, on average, girls gain about 40 pounds right after puberty and that, you know, in that next decade. If we don't know that's coming, we may think something's wrong with us, especially in our social comparison world, right? We see things on Instagram that we're supposed to be so skinny. And so we see a big issue with eating disorders and social media pairing together, having a synergistic effect. So we want to let them know ahead of time, because when they don't know, it creates more anxiety and fear. And I think parents have a lot of anxiety and fear. Like, I don't know how to talk to kids about that. This is why in the book, all 18 high-risk behavior, I teach you how to talk about it, give you a script and a checklist to empower you so that you know what to say. And a lot of parents will like, can I say this? Is this okay? Yes. The answer to that is always yes. We want to do it in a developmentally appropriate way. That's why I put those high-risk behavior in age of occurrence. There's an elementary, middle, and high school chapter so that you know, okay, I have to talk about this in elementary school. One of the things that I thought was so interesting, Miriam, about high-risk behavior and age, I thought we wouldn't have to talk about suicide to the middle school chapter, but we need to start talking about it in late elementary school, because that is unfortunately when kids start to hear about suicide. And so when kids hear about it at school or their friend, right, it creates fear and anxiety. But if they hear about it from us and we're calm, but we don't know how to talk about that. So in the elementary school chapter, I literally have a script for each age, preschool on up. Because if somebody in the family or they know someone that has, we've got to be able to talk about it in a way that they understand. But that can elude us. So, right? Yes.
Yeah, I was going to say, actually, what my kids see, my husband and I are very, we have talked to them about sex. We have talked, although sometimes when we have also told them the same thing, when you go to school or to someone else's home, you do not talk about these things. We are okay. Some other parent might not be okay about this. So you don't want to talk about it. However, I will be honest, the one subject that I'm really tippy-toeing is suicide. I feel like, am I giving them the idea there's something that exists that, and now it's going to give them the idea that if something is hard down the life, this is my own brain, that now they're going to look at that. So now that you're telling me it's okay to talk about it, is okay now. I mean, coming from you now, I'm feeling a little better that maybe I should talk. Like, what age is the right age?
So I always say to parents, you know your child. And so you want to always make sure that you know the developmental level, the anxiety level of a child, and if they're mature enough to have the conversation. So if you go to that section in the elementary chapter, it tells you a literal script of what to say for each age. And so you may not have a talk about it unless you hear about it in your community or your neighborhood, or when they get into late elementary, like before they go into middle school. It could be one of your topics. You could say, hey, you guys know that this week is National Suicide Prevention Week. Have you guys ever heard that word? Do you know what it means? Let's talk about how that somebody might feel so sick from mental illness that they may take their own lives. Have you ever heard of that? I just want you to be aware of that word, because if you hear about it, here's what to do. Come home and tell me immediately, and then we can talk about it some more. That's it. Like, that's it, right? It doesn't have to be, there's a myth too. The myth is that if I talk about it, it introduces an idea.
Exactly. That's what, in this subject, I'm very wary.
Yes. Well, a lot of people don't talk about drugs because they don't want to introduce the idea. But
no, we talked actually about them, right? In California, we have a lot of crisis of when it comes to, I don't know about Texas, but here it's like fentanyl crisis and all these things. So we have talked to them about, you know, what to do. And we have told them not to take food from anyone. Poor kids. I mean, I feel like I'm like telling telling them so many things at such a young age. But also, I feel like as a parent, I have to, like you said, inform them and educate them so they're ready when it comes that they could say
exactly.
No.
Exactly. Like, and what I make up is that they're not walking around scared and paranoid. They're walking around feeling empowered and ready. That's what we want, right? We want them to feel that way.
Yes.
So, you know, if we come and go, oh my God, this is going to happen. If we come that way, anxious and scared, of course they're going to be. But if we sit down at dinner and say, hey, let's talk about how to protect your brain. Let's talk about this. Have you heard about this? I want you to be empowered. Then they're going to feel informed, empowered. They're going to feel mature enough that mom and dad talk to me about this stuff. And because it's really interesting too about suicide is that kids will that have suicidal thoughts, they actually go to friends before they go to adults, the majority of kids. And so it's very important, like before kids get to middle school, to be able to say, if somebody ever came to you and said they were engaging in a high-risk behavior, or they didn't want to be here anymore, or they dropped hints about this, let's talk about what to do. And here's what I want you to say is, hey, I take suicide very seriously. So let's go to your parent. Let's go to the counselor. Let's go. I take this seriously and I love and care about you. So come on. We want to empower kids to say those things to their friends because they're going to hear it.
Oh, yes, definitely. This era, I believe I hear everything and anything, and it's best, like you said, to be informed about it. Yes, the time is almost getting there, but I have a couple of questions where our listeners have also submitted. We are seeing rising rates of anxiety, depression, and substance use in teens, which we have talked a little bit. How are these issues interconnected, and what can parents do to support their kids?
So there's some commonalities here. There's screens. The younger that we have screen time, the less connected, attached we might feel to our adults. The less connected and attached we feel to our family and our loved ones, the more anxiety and depression we might have. The less we go out and experience new things, the more anxiety about new things we're going to have. The more screen time we have, the less we're going to know, the less empowered we're going to have, the less courage to go out and talk about and face things. We'll have less communication skills the younger we are exposed to screen time. And so we see this huge correlation across the past couple decades as the introduction of screen time has infiltrated our lives younger and younger. So in the book, I've got screen time and digital dangers in all three age groups and a bunch of tools in the tools section about it. We want to follow the American Pediatric Society's guidelines on screen time. And we also want to teach kids about anxiety and depression. Anxiety is just a feeling. It means you care about something, right? If you have anxiousness, that means you want to gain something, your fear of losing something, or you want to impress something. So to teach kids, this is a normal feeling. Let's learn how to cope with it. I have a kiddo that I work with who has a fear of talking on the phone just because she never did it. She doesn't know what to say. She doesn't know how to have a phone conversation, which is a tickle to me because I was on the phone. You couldn't get me off the phone when I was a teenager, right?
Yeah. It's, I think, like you said, it's fear of it. She has never done it.
Never done it. So what we want to do is really help our kids get exposed to lots of things, have them do lots of chores, having a sense of purpose makes you feel useful in the world. It brings a peace and a calm that so many kids don't have today. And they're so struggling with, okay, well, if I'm useless and I don't have a purpose, I'm just going to smoke weed or I'm going to just play video games all day long. Like, what's the point of learning this class, in college and paying attention? So remember that anxiety, depression, and screen time, they all go hand in hand. But also attachment and connection to an adult. The biggest predictor of how much a kid will have screen time is their parents' screen time. So learning that when a kid walks into a room, no matter how old they are, they're the most important person there. We put down all of our devices. We have a ritual of connection, a hug, a kiss. There's a point when they stop letting us do that, right? And then we sit down and say, tell me about your day, what happened. Even if it's 5 minutes, We sit, we break bread together at least 3 to 5 times per week. We have these rituals of connection that keep the conversation open. And that actually is a protective factor against anxiety and depression.
Wow, that's great. That's so reassuring. And thank you for saying each step, because as parents, we need to hear that. And it's good to know from someone so vast knowledge like you to tell us this. And it's really good to follow. My other question is, many parents feel helpless when they suspect their teen is struggling with addiction. What are early signs that your kid or your teenager is struggling? And I know I had friends when they're struggling with addiction, it was just that parents didn't know because they were good at hiding it. And how would we know if, you know, your kid is doing
it? Sure. Well, and it also depends upon what addiction, because I've seen kids being debilitatingly addicted to video games. And so the first few signs are a change of friends, change in grades, a change in mood and attitude. Now, most kids become snarky, you know, and argumentative when they move into adolescence. That's normal. But when it becomes disrespectful, when they're starting to isolate, when they won't let you meet the friends that they are hanging out with, those kind of are really big signs. If you smell it, you know, all of those different things. And so that's why it's critical to get involved. And if you miss the windows of prevention, that doesn't mean all is lost. Because I want parents to think about brain development. You are protecting that brain development. Once a kid is 25 years old, their executive functioning skills, the processing speed, all of those networks are peaking in many ways. We keep learning for the rest of our lives, but all of those basic brain skills in the frontal lobe are fully developed. You want to protect that. Risky behavior and addiction arrests the development of those skills. And so, as much as they don't want you to get involved. And the script is, I got to protect your brain, especially if you won't. So we're going to go see a counselor. And if they is like, I don't need it. You may not think you need it, but you've earned it. And so we're going because we love you and we care about you and we can't let this continue. It's not okay to hurt yourself or hurt us. So let's go and figure out what's going on. Find a clinician that has expertise in the areas that you're concerned about. And then, you know, once a child has violated the family code about substances, and even if you didn't have a family code, if they're using substances, that's obviously against the rules. They have earned drug testing. They have earned nicotine testing. They've earned it now. And so in the tools section of the book, I have a how to drug test, what that looks like. And please hear me. It sucks. It is not fun to drug test your kid, but you are protecting their future brain development and being able to say, we love you enough. You can't do this. And it also gives kids the number one refusal skill. When they go to a party, they can say, no, my dad drug tests me. Yeah, they get, it's funny because they'll get empathy from other kids like, oh, that sucks. And okay, it may be an awkward situation for that kid, but it protects their brain. And I've seen from so many kids whose parents do this is that they hate it at first, they don't like it, but as soon as their parents stop, they feel unloved, they feel uncared about. And so they may do it again. It's really, really interesting, right? So they can't create impulse control and make the decision on their own. They don't have enough frontal lobe to do that. So we have to be that frontal lobe until they grow one of their own.
See, that's interesting. I was thinking that if you push them so much to take a drug test and do these things, it will make them more disconnected from you. But it's the opposite, right? Because they need that. Their frontal lobe needs you to help them make the right decision.
Exactly. I see this a lot. It's a very valid worry and concern. Parents are worried they're going to push their child away and disconnect them. But they're already disconnected if they're doing drugs and alcohol, right? They're already, their frontal lobe is not on, the part of the brain that connects us to other people. And it's not fun when your kid hates you at any age. It's not fun when they're angry at you at any age. But if you enable them to continue using by being quiet, you're also telling them, I don't care enough about you for you to be angry at me for doing the right thing.
Wow, I'm so glad you brought your resources to us. It's going to not only help me and our community, because we all have kids growing. And I always tell my husband and even our friends group, our number one investment is our kids. Imagine having them well-informed and well-educated on these things, and your investment flourishes into a productive human is my dream.
That's our job, right? Yes. Is to raise kids who are fully self-supporting, healthy relational adults. That's the goal.
Exactly. You have a new book called Faux Mapping. Is that how you
say it? No, it's actually called Foo Mapping.
Foo. Yes. Okay. Foo. How did you come up with that? And what is it about?
So Foo stands for family of origin. Religion of origin, Su, society of origin, or Ku, culture of origin. They all affect brain development. And how you learned to react in your family of origin creates networks in your brain for thinking, feeling, and behavioral patterns. So if you grew up in a really wonderful, healthy, firm, warm, loving environment, you're going to have wonderful coping mechanisms that are naturally there for healthy behavior. If you grew up in an environment where something was going on that wasn't as healthy, you're going to learn how to cope with that in certain ways. And those ways, when you take those networks into your adult world, they may not serve you very well. So I learned that in order to get approval from my mother, to see a smile on her face, to bring home all A's, just to be perfect. And avoiding criticism from her was doing everything right, saying everything right. So I learned that I'm not good enough the way I am, and that perfection equals love. So that created a lot of shame and guilt in me whenever I made mistakes. And then the way that I handled that was to really exceed to the point where I would hurt myself, studying for days and days and days and days, rewarding myself with drugs and alcohol, like really behavior that does not serve me well. Then when I got sober, I still have those networks in my brain that expect myself to be perfect and to not feel good enough and to deal with the shame and guilt of that. So what I started doing many years ago in my therapy practice with clients is I would draw their foo button on the board, because I could see that when their button was pushed, it's almost like they would regress back to the age when the wounding happened, and they would see and feel and do things that they did when they were kids, but yet they're adults. We all do that. When we're acting in really immature ways, when we're having a full-on adult temper tantrum, that means our foo button's pushed. And that means that we're not in our adult energy anymore. We're back in that wounded kid doing exactly what we learned how to do then. That may have worked then in an unhealthy system, but it doesn't work now. So I do foo mapping with people that want to learn, why do I keep doing this behavior that's not serving me? And it also teaches you those five sub-stages of neurodevelopment. So we go through a person's life history and we figure out, okay, where did good development happen? Healthy, wonderful things. And then where did we go astray? And how did our brain develop networks? Then once we have a map, we work on reconnecting new neurons, creating new networks for healthier thinking, feeling, and behavioral pattern.
Wow. I want that book. Is it out yet?
Yes, the Foo Mapping workbook is out.
Oh, good then. I can order it on Amazon.
Absolutely. I designed it to be a workbook so that you could learn about it and do it at home. But I also recommend doing it with a therapist. You know, going through the book, development by development, you'll go through five neurodevelopmental stages and then you end up with a map. And then you can really plan like, oh, okay, what do I need to do? What is really important for people to know is that some of our best therapies out there, like CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, it has amazing short-term benefits and terrible long-term results. Why? Why does our best therapy have terrible long-term results? Because we don't practice new behavior, and then we don't create new neural networking for it, and then we just keep using the same old neural network over and over. So we have to practice. So having your map is the first step, but then really putting that into action. I have a group that meets once a month. All these people have done Foo Maps. We call them Foo Fighters. Kind of a shout out to Dave Grohl's band as well. But, you know, because we have to fight those networks. Even if we have really beautiful, wonderful, healthy families, we may still have a Foo button that doesn't serve us very well. And that's changing the neural network of our brain one dendrite at a time.
That's amazing. With my last two questions. First, would you tell all our listeners all the books and resources that you have so they can have access to
them? Sure. If you go to Amazon and look up even just one of my books and then click on the author, it'll take you to my author page. You could also go to my website. The Neuro Whereabouts Guide has them all listed, and Know Your Neuro, the online program, has them listed too. But if we start off with the first book, which is the Neuro Whereabouts Guide for Parents, and then we have the children's books. So I have designed a 10-book children's series called Know Your Neuro, Adventures of a Growing Brain. And right now, the fifth in the series is about to be published. So by the end of maybe this year or 2 years from now, all 10 will be out. The first book teaches kids about their brain. And then the rest of the books teach, you get to go on adventures with Neuro, the superhero.
Yes.
People keep sending me pictures of their kids reading these books. The second one is Neuro Makes Good Choices. Third is Neuro Feels Feelings.
That's the one that we have, and we're ordering the others. What I like is not only, I have told you this from the beginning, it's not even just for the kids. When us parents, my husband and I read, we come up with things too. We're like, oh yeah, this, that.
Good.
So you also don't get bored. I will tell you this, your book I have read a couple of times. Usually the kids book, I don't want to be mean, but after a couple you're like, okay, I'm done. But with this one, you can read and read. Every time you get a new perspective. I think that's the secret about your books, because it makes you think in different ways too, like how your brain works. At least that's what my husband and I and the kids are getting.
Oh, Mary, that makes me so happy. I have tears. That really, I just want you to know that feedback is beautiful, because it's what I hope to happen, is that parents sit there and then they also refer back to it, you know, protect your brain.
Yes.
When you're out in public. Like, is that a good choice? Are you showing up with your best self right now? Oh, let's have some emotional literacy. What is the label of that feeling? And then, so the book that's about to come out is Neuro Sets Boundaries. And I'm so excited about that, because the idea of teaching kids about their hula hoop, right? And what's inside of it and how to protect it, including the brain and the body. That's the next one. Then we're going to have Neuro deals with body image. Neuro has good self-talk. Neuro says
love it.
All of the refusal skills. So it'll be all those early executive functioning skills that you'll teach kids. And there are two versions. There's a kindergarten through second grade, and then there's a grade 3 through 5. So you can start your littles on the appropriate and your biggers on the appropriate age. The other book I have is Foo Mapping, the Family of Origin workbook. And then the next book that will be coming out this year, besides more kids' books, is the Neuro Whereabouts Guide for Youth. And so it's going to be a playbook for kids that's called Your Moves Matter, because they do, right? And I've had so many kids over the past few years see the adult book sitting on the coffee table, and they tell their moms, I want one for me. I want one that has all of this information that's written in my language. So that's what I'm responding to with my interns that are helping me create that for kids.
That's amazing, because we have a youth podcast. It's Tomorrow's Table podcast. And this podcast is actually internationally across states. And that's what we are doing even with Solano Moms. We are now collaborating with you from a different state, which we're trying to bring all the resources to a community, and you collaborating with us. Like, I will be talking to the library of my kids' school, bringing these neuro books. I actually talked to her on Friday. I said, I'll be bringing some books where it's amazing books. And the librarian was very excited.
Good. Yay. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that.
Of course. Thank you to you. The last question will be, how can parents create a home environment that promotes healthy decision making and we will have resilient children? We already talked about it, but tell us just one thing at the end where that could stick to our mind.
The one thing, I thought about this so many things, Mary, it's hard to answer that question, but the one thing that I think is critical is to have a family code. and it's easy to create. I've been doing family code workshops all over on Know Your Neuro, the school page. I have a PowerPoint that you can download for free that you can do a family code workshop at your church or your community center or your school. You don't even need me. It's easy to do. Do that around age 7. And even if your littles are there, let them color, right? The first step is let everybody draw a picture of the family. And then the second step is you're going to want to write down your family values. The third step is you're going to write down the no's. Then you put them all into 3 or 4 sentences. Put it on the wall when you're finished. That's your family code. Literally put the children's picture that they drew with your code on it on the wall. Then over the years, have 6 conversations per year about a variety of different risky behavior and refer back to the code. If you can do that consistently, starting young, you will see kids reacting in healthy, healthy ways, knowing what your expectations are and saying no to risky behavior.
Thank you so much. That is amazing advice for all the parents. I'm sure my listeners are going to love it. I'm sure more of our populations, when they hear about you, they're going to love this. Thank you for taking the time. I hate to say it, we're going to end this, although I want to keep you all day.
thank you so much for having me. It's such an honor. I really love and support all the moms out there that are raising kids' brains in the healthiest way possible. So whatever I can do to help.
Thank you.